Today at Reader's Corner, National Book Award winner Nathaniel Philbrick, author of Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution.
New England and the other colonies had really enjoyed a time of what's been called salutary neglect. The empire left the colonists to do pretty much as they pleased. After the conclusion of the French and Indian War, Britain was looking to get the colonists to pay for their upkeep. But the colonists said, hey, wait, we're 3,000 miles of ocean between the two of us. We need to have input in how we pay. The British attempt to stop the revolution was hamstrung by its inability to respond quickly, while the Patriots were there and had a real advantage when it came to the escalating tensions.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On June 17, 1775, a ragtag army of colonial patriots faced off against the most powerful army of the 18th century. Their goal was to prevent the British regulars from occupying the hills surrounding Boston in order to put an end to a months-long siege of the city. What ensued proved to be the bloodiest battle of the Revolution and marked the tipping point for the colonists. Today's guest, Nathaniel Philbrick, details the events leading up to this fateful conflict in his new book, Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. The book brings to life a colonial New England where once loyal British citizens struggled to deal with the aftermath of the Boston Massacre, the Boston Tea Party, and the escalating quest for true liberty. Mr. Philbrick won the National Book Award in nonfiction for In the Heart of the Sea, and he was a Pulitzer Award finalist for Mayflower. Feature film rights have been optioned for both In the Heart of the Sea and Bunker Hill. Nathaniel Philbrick will be visiting Boise on Thursday, September 26th, to speak at the Idaho Distinguished Humanities Lecture and Dinner presented by the Idaho Humanities Council. You can find out more about the event and order tickets online at www.idahohumanities.org. Mr. Philbrick joins us by phone for this interview. Nathaniel Philbrick, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
So this isn't the first time I've interviewed an author who was able to say that they had their book optioned for feature film rights. But I guess I've really never asked the question, so what does that mean? What's the likelihood that this book winds up on the big screen?
That's a really good question. And as you mentioned, my earlier book, In the Heart of the Sea, has been optioned, and it actually looks like it will be come a film. Filming starts this month, and so that has been greenlit, and it's going to happen, but it took all of 13 years after it was initially optioned to become a film in production. And so, you know, I have great hopes for Bunker Hill. I think it would make a great film. And Ben Affleck, who has got the option, I can't think of a director who knows Boston better.
Really?
And so, you know, I am a very interested observer, and we'll see what happens.
So what role will you play as they make this movie? Have you been asked to be a consultant in many cases, or at least in some cases, authors find their way onto the screen in a very small part?
Right. Well, for example, in The Heart of the Sea, my wife and I are, it's being filmed in England at the Warner Brothers lot outside London, and then on site in the Canary Islands. And we're going to visit the set for one day, and no plans to actually be preserved on film. But what we'll be watching, it's interesting. That book is about a Nantucket whale ship that was rammed by a whale and sunk and inspired the conclusion of Moby Dick. And we'll be there when they're shooting the scenes on a Nantucket that they've created on the lot. And I've seen models of it.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, so it's a very interesting process. And it really comes down to what the director needs as far as input from the author. And so in the case of Ron Howard, who's the director for In the Heart of the Sea, he's a very curious and detailed person, and so I've had a lot of input, and it's been very interesting to see how they're going about it, and we'll see what happens with Bunker Hill.
Well, if you're working with Ron Howard, you're working with the best, so that's great news.
Yeah, and yeah. It's such a collaborative medium. When you write a book, it's all in your head, and you're dealing with archival materials and other forms of data. but it's really something that, it's within your control. This is something very different, where it's visual, it's sound, it's very complex, a cast of thousands, really, when it comes to putting it all together. So it's been fun to watch the wheels turn.
Well, that's really great, and we hope the same thing happens with Bunker Hill. But in the meantime, let's talk about Bunker Hill. What was life like for the colonists in the 1760s and the 1770s in regard to their relationship with Great Britain?
Yeah, well, the New England and the other colonies had really enjoyed a time of what's been called salutary neglect, where the empire left the colonists to do pretty much as they pleased, with 3,000 miles of ocean between them and the mother country. But after the conclusion of the French and Indian War, that had put the British Empire more than $20 billion in debt, Britain was looking to get the colonists to pay for their upkeep. And from their perspective, from Great Britain's perspective, it wasn't a question of robbing them of their liberties. It was just a question of making them fulfill their fiscal responsibilities. And the colonists, however, saw it very differently. Their ancestors had carved out a living in this wilderness and without much help from the empire, and now the empire wanted to tax them. And so they were really looking to keep it the way it had always been. And while Great Britain was trying to modernize their empire into what would become the empire that would dominate the 19th century.
And it was the Stamp Act and the Townshend Acts that were the principal culprits?
Yeah, and those were attempts to get the colonists to pay for their upkeep by the empire. But the colonists said, hey, wait, we're over here. We're 3,000 miles of ocean between the two of us, and we've done it on our own so far, and we need to have input in how we pay. And so it wasn't a question so much of whether or not they should pay. All agreed that was right. It was determining how that would happen, and that came to the question of the sovereignty of the ministry and parliament and the king, and there was the rub.
Mm-hmm. Well, notwithstanding the fact that I do remember that famous phrase, taxation without representation, as I read your book, I was thinking back to my own education in American history, and elementary level, high school level, college level. And I must admit, and maybe I'm just out of it here, but I must admit that I felt like I was looking back on a time when people were severely oppressed, when there was oppression in the United States from this King of England. When I read your book, I come away with a slightly different take on it. Obviously, you're documenting these Townshend Acts and Stamp Acts as history has, but it doesn't sound like life was quite as rough on these folks as my early childhood history seems to leave me with.
Well, no, I grew up with that same kind of attitude, that it was, good patriots against evil loyalists.
Right.
and British. And the fact of the matter was the colonists at this time were the least taxed and freest people in the British Empire. Their tax burden was much less than those living in England. And so from the British government perspective, it was about time that the colonists contributed to their upkeep. Well, the colonists, saw themselves as they wanted to keep it the way it had been, and if it was going to change, they wanted input on how that would change. Well, Great Britain said, wait a minute, you are our colonies. We have sovereignty over you. And that disagreement would get escalated, and with most people sort of in the middle, not really caring anything about all this, wanting it to be the way it had always been. They
right.
wanted their lives to go on, and those on each on the edges of it, as this escalated, those people in the middle were drawn in, and it would all explode eventually in the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm. So, help us understand the term the colonists. I mean, it's not like there's an American government over here. That hasn't happened yet. So these basically are folks who are in the hinterlands who have found a way to come together, but not necessarily in an organized fashion at first.
Yeah, each colony had its own government. There was a Massachusetts General Court, which was their legislative body, and there was a governor. And it's interesting, each colony had a sort of different approach. The Connecticut did not have a royal governor. They had their own governor, while Massachusetts had a royal-appointed governor and so had ties to the king. And what this created was a growing rift between the legislatures who were elected from the various towns and the governor, whose main loyalty was to the king. And so that growing tension would contribute to what became the outbreak of violence.
And one of those incidents, of course, was the Boston Tea Party. How did that get off the ground?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. With the Tea Party, we tend to think of it as New Englanders were objecting to this onerous tax that would make tea so expensive. But in actuality, what happened was the British government was trying to unload a lot of extra tea that they had, that the East India Company had. And so they lowered the price of it drastically. And this meant that it was really a windfall to the colonists. However, the British government made the mistake of including a slight tax, and it was this tax, almost on ideological grounds, that the colonists objected to. Also involved in this was the fact that many Boston merchants had made good money on smuggling in illegal Dutch tea that was cheaper than the original price of the East India tea. But with the Tea Act, it was lowered so that it was suddenly the British tea was less than the Dutch tea. And so many of these smugglers objected to this because it would cut out their bottom line. But they also had ideological grounds since there was a tax involved.
You're listening to Nathaniel Philbrick. He's the author of Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. And he will be visiting Boise on Thursday, September 26th, to speak at the Idaho Distinguished Humanities Lecture and Dinner presented by the Idaho Humanities Council. So one of our future founding fathers, Samuel Adams, was perhaps an instigator here?
Yes. You know, it's interesting. No one was in charge of the revolution. No one was pressing the button that made things happen. This was much bigger than any one person. But Samuel Adams had been there for more than a decade, watching very carefully and really embodied what the revolution would become about. He saw the demographics, that here was a small island off the coast of Europe trying to control 13 colonies on a vast continent. And so he was involved in all that. And one of the people I focus on in my book is Joseph Warren, a young 33-year-old doctor who really worked side by side with Samuel Adams in all this. And what you see are people who become increasingly politicized as Great Britain insists on its right to determine how these taxes will be collected.
Well, this is Joseph Warren. I was fascinated by your discussion of Joseph Warren. I have to admit, I don't remember reading much about Joseph Warren. He seems like the founding father who didn't make it to the history books.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. The three founding fathers we associate with the revolution in Boston, there's John Adams, Samuel Adams, and John Hancock. And the fact of the matter is they were off-site when the revolution was happening in Boston. They were at the Continental Congress, 300 miles to the south in Philadelphia. And it would be left to others to orchestrate the on-the-ground revolution. And, you know, we've all heard of Paul Revere. But it was Joseph Warren who gave Paul Revere the orders to alert the countryside that the British were headed for Concord. And this 33-year-old doctor, he was a widower with four children between the ages of 2 and 8, he was the one who would emerge as the de facto leader. He would send Paul Revere out, and in the days after Lexington and Concord, as thousands of colonial militiamen surrounded Boston, and the soldiers inside Boston were now under siege, Warren would emerge as the president of the provincial Congress. He would become a major general, and if he hadn't died at Bunker Hill, tragically, he might have been one of the founding fathers we all revere today.
Yeah, I think you even go so far as to say that George Washington might have been a footnote in history.
Well, you know, one of the loyalists who had no great love for Joseph Warren by any means did say that if he hadn't died at Bunker Hill, he thought that George Washington, who appeared 2.5 weeks after the Battle of Bunker Hill to take over what would become the Continental Army, this loyalist, Peter Oliver, claimed that if Warren had lived, Washington would have been an obscurity, which is an interesting thing to contemplate.
Well, it sure is. Now, Joseph Warren drafted the 19 resolves, Nathaniel. Help us understand what they were and what role they play here.
Yes, in the Suffolk Resolves. And, you know, this was an early document. This was written in the September of 1774. And it was something that was put together and delivered by Paul Revere down to the First Continental Congress in Philadelphia, which had just sat. And it created a sensation, really, in the Continental Congress and pushed this group in an unusually radical direction very early on. And it was written by Joseph Warren. This was just the beginning of his emergence as really the leader, political leader of what was going on in the Patriot cause in Boston. And so right from the beginning, you see that, this is someone who is eloquent, articulate, but there's also was a swashbuckling aspect to Joseph Warren. When Lexington and Concord erupted, he would go out there and be there, right there with the militiamen. And he was a young leader who had the energy and the edginess to be there as a revolution was unfolding.
This issue of writing various communications and moving them through the countryside, you mentioned Paul Revere, is interesting, especially from the standpoint of Britain trying to communicate with the homeland, with the loyalist in America trying to communicate with the homeland. Sometimes, of course, it took several weeks to get messages across the ocean. How did that time lag contribute to the growing unrest?
Well, you know, that time lag was everything. You can look to Paul Revere as kind of the fax machine of the Patriot cause. You know, because of people like Paul Revere, the Patriots had an ability to communicate with one another that was way beyond anything the Loyalists and British officers could come up with. And the reality was there was 3,000 miles of ocean between the colonies and Great Britain, and it took more than a month for a ship to go across that ocean, and then it took about a month for the British ministry to figure out how to respond to what was going on, and then it took another month to come back, and by that time, what they came up with was probably irrelevant as events moved on. And so this meant that the British attempt to stop the revolution was hamstrung by its inability to respond quickly, while the Patriots were there. And with people like Paul Revere keeping messages going back and forth, they had a real advantage when it came to the escalating tensions.
And refresh our memory, or at least my memory, about Paul Revere's ride. How long was that?
Yeah, well, you know, he was, we all know, because of the Longfellow poem about Paul Revere's ride, you know, we all know about the midnight ride of Paul Revere when he headed out on the night of April 18, 1775 to alert the countryside that the British were headed to Concord. And so he headed out from, rode across the Boston Harbor to Charlestown, and then made his way all the way up to Lexington and alerting people all the way. But up until this, he had been doing this kind of thing for the Patriots for months, and he'd make several trips down to Philadelphia, an extremely grueling trip, 300 miles over terrible roads. And so that he was a real ace in the hole when it came to the Patriot cause, just because they could get the word out so quickly.
So let's talk about the Battle of Bunker Hill itself. How did this come to be?
Yeah, well, this erupted 60 days after Lexington and Concord, and Boston by this time was, you know, had been the center of Patriot defiance, was now a British occupied city under siege by the militiamen. And the British at this point wanted to break out of the siege to try to stop this revolution in its tracks. And so there was a plan to move on the Patriots who were encamped in Cambridge and in Roxbury. The Patriots heard about it and decided to try, in an attempt to delay it, that they would occupy the high ground on the Charlestown Peninsula, which is just across Boston Harbor from Boston. And that in the night of June 16, 1775, the decision was made, and we're still not quite sure why. The original hope was to build a fort on what's called Bunker Hill, which is high ground, the highest point on the Charlestown Peninsula. But for reasons that are still unclear, a fort was built much closer to Boston, a half mile to the south, on what's known as Breed's Hill, overlooking Boston Harbor. When June 17 dawned and General Gage looked across and saw this fort atop Breed's Hill, he decided they must attack. And so that afternoon, he would send 2,000 British regulars across the harbor, and by this time, thousands of Patriot militiamen had dug themselves in from the fort diagonally across the Charlestown Peninsula. And what would unfold was the first pitched battle of what would become a war of independence. And the British assumed that if the militiamen were faced with the awesome sight of the most powerful army in the world, that they would run. But they did not run, and it would take three British charges before finally they took the fort on Breed's Hill. And so it was a British victory, but in one sense, but it was a Pyrrhic victory, because they would suffer casualties of 50%, making it the bloodiest battle of the entire 8 years of the American Revolution.
Casualties in excess of the British.
Yes, so the British were the ones that were really hurt in this, even though it was a victory, and all knew after this the Battle of Bunker Hill, which was a real spectator event. All the people living in Boston watched this battle from the rooftops of their houses, and it was just a horrifying thing to see. And it became clear after this battle that what had begun with skirmishes in Lexington and Concord was now all-out war. And so it's really the turning point of the Revolution, where an uprising becomes a war of independence.
You're listening to Nathaniel Philbrick. He's the author of Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. There was a critical shortage of gunpowder on the part of the Patriot militia. How was that resolved?
Yeah, well, and that was, it's interesting. If the Patriots had had all the gunpowder they needed, they might have actually won this battle. The British were able to take the fort after the third charge, mainly because the Patriots had run out of gunpowder. All gunpowder at this time came from England, and so that once tensions mounted to the point of armed conflict, the British stopped shipments of gunpowder over to the colonies, and so that the colonists only had a limited amount of gunpowder at this point. And so if they had had more and hadn't run out, it could have been the victory that stopped this conflict very early on, but it didn't, and it would go on for a full 8 years.
And that issue brought forth a very famous line that we all remember as kids, something about don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes.
Yes, and this is one of the great mythic phrases of the Revolution, and don't fire till you see the whites of their eyes. It's interesting, and there's no specific historical evidence that was actually said. We know someone
said,
do not fire until you see the whites of their half gaiters, which were the splash guards that the British had on their feet. But it doesn't have the ring that
right.
You fire to see the whites of their eyes. But the fact of the matter is they were extremely disciplined, these militiamen, and they waited until the British were within 50 yards of their line, and then unleashed their volleys, which wreaked terrible casualties on the British. And so this was a startling turn of events for the British officers, who didn't think these militiamen were capable of this kind of discipline and bravery. And it did show everyone that a new phase was coming in terms of this conflict, and that it would likely spread from New England to the rest of the colonies.
There was also a very specific instruction that had to do with the shade of red of the enemy's coats. The militiamen were told to look for this certain shade of red. That's a very interesting aspect of this war.
There's a subtlety there. The officers had a different shade of red. It was actually scarlet. They had a higher quality dye in their uniforms. And so you could distinguish an officer from a common soldier whose uniform was a more washed out red, almost orange. And so what the Patriots did was they made a point of aiming at the officers. And this meant that, had a devastating effect on the army. General Howe, William Howe, was the one who led the British forces on the field, and he led by example. He was right there in the front lines, and he would lose everyone in his staff, was either killed or wounded. It's a miracle that he survived the battle, but this was because they were firing they were aiming for the officers, and so this contributed to the terrible losses and the fact that it took three charges before the British could claim victory.
And of course, as you said earlier, one of those deaths was Joseph Warren, and the military needs a new commander-in-chief. So what happens next?
Yeah, and unknown to the Continental Congress in Philadelphia, all of this was happening. And at this time, Washington was named head of what would become the Continental Army. And so he arrives 10 days after the Battle of Bunker Hill and steps into the power vacuum that was left with the death of Warren. And he was, in all honesty, he was not pleased with what he found. He was someone from Virginia. Virginia had a very different culture from New England. Virginia was a hierarchical society. In New England, where the town meeting was a form of government that encouraged collective action in politics, people weren't used to taking orders, even in the military. And so Washington was faced with turning this amateur army of militiamen into a professional army. And he had to get through the fact that many of these New Englanders were very distrustful of anyone out that they didn't know. And it would be left to Washington to do what was probably the hardest work of the Revolution, and that was getting this group of very parochial New Englanders to begin thinking of themselves not as from Massachusetts or New Hampshire or Connecticut, but members of America. And that's where I think Washington had, to see what he had to confront after the Battle of Bunker Hill is fascinating, and he is clearly the pivotal figure of when it comes to turning this revolution into a war that creates a new country.
And I think you said that if you go back to Washington's time as a veteran of the French Indian Wars, he really didn't do a great job of maintaining command over his men, so he might not have been the most likely candidate for this job if it weren't for the circumstances you just described.
Yes, he was from Virginia, and so that was something that contributed to his being chosen. There were several British officers who had were now a part of the American cause and were much more experienced when it came to leading men into battle. And, Washington is a fascinating example of someone who had the ability to learn on the job, who would make mistakes just as we all do, but had the force of character and the patience and the stick-to-itness to learn and get better and adapt to the circumstances. And that's what you see during the next year of what became the Siege of Boston, where he is trying to figure out how he's going to get the British out of Boston and turn this ragtag group of New Englanders into a professional army. And it's a fascinating lesson in leadership and cultural chemistry as he achieves which was really almost impossible when you think about it. Here was this army of British, almost 9,000 soldiers in Boston, and eventually they would be forced to evacuate, and the revolution would move to the South in New York.
Well, Nathaniel, we've run out of time, but I must say I really do appreciate your coming on board here and doing the interview. And most importantly, we're excited about your visit to Boise, and that is on September 26th at the annual Idaho Distinguished Humanities Lecture and Dinner presented by the Idaho Humanities Council. You can find out more and order tickets at idahohumanities.org. Nathaniel Philbrick, thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Oh, thanks. It's been a pleasure, and I'm looking forward to coming to Boise.
And we are as well. Next week, Melanie Kirkpatrick, author of Escape from North Korea, The Untold Story of Asia's Underground Railroad. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.